Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
No, you can't go. You can't go. You just... Please just sit on the couch. I did get the new Vanity Fair. Read it.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. We're here to discuss the third episode of the HBO series The White Lotus, Full Elephants. This episode, we've got a lot of characters getting up to no good in various pools, a Godfather tour, and the arrival of an honest-to-God fortune teller.
And we'll also hear Chris's talk with Michael Imperioli, the television veteran whose character Dominic seems to be heading towards some positive steps, maybe, even if he seems really miserable about it.
I think sexual politics and sexual dynamics between, you know, men and women and masculine and feminine, it's an ancient thing, which I think why Sicily makes it kind of the perfect backdrop for it.
There is also the ongoing and all-important question of who winds up dead at the end of the show. Each week at the end of the episode, Richard and I are going to debate who we think is dead.
And we're going to fold in your theories that you send to us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And to keep ourselves kind of accountable and raise the stakes a little bit, whoever predicts right, you or me, Chris, wins an Aperol Spritz.
Yes, even though you don't like them. So if I win, I get an Aperol Spritz, and you have to drink one.
So Chris, this episode is where things start to go wrong. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I was going to say this is the episode where things start to pop off.
Yeah, it gets a little more exciting.
It gets a little sexy. It gets a little...
more mysterious.
Yes, a little dangerous, too.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And I think that this is also the episode where Megan Fahey's already wonderful performance really kicks into gear. So let's start with Daphne.
Fully read my mind. She is the... Not that episodes need to have an MVP, but she blew me out of the water this episode, specifically with her sort of girl strip / kidnapping of Harper.
Yeah. A total scam. Like, she's like, I just on a whim rented this villa. Oh, but I thought to pack extra toothpaste and toothbrushes.
I'm always
stuff.
Bringing extra toothpaste with me on day trips with my girlfriends.
And so she and Harper are inextricably linked in this episode. Mm. And that starts because Harper is determined that she's going to be fun now and friendly now.
She's going to change.
Yeah. And she has this very scuttled attempt at morning sex with Ethan. And it doesn't go well because she's like, but you're supposed to be horny after you run. And he's like, there's clearly something more happening there. But she still sticks to her plan to be nice. She shows up to breakfast all sunny. Look at the beautiful weather.
She's wearing a headband.
It's her new Italian look, you know.
How nice is the sky? Just things that we're not used to seeing Harper engage with.
And I think that Aubrey Plaza is really good at playing that falseness, you know, it's believable enough, but...
And I do believe that she's actually trying to change. I do believe that she's trying to be this fresh, sunny, easy-breezy Harper that might not really exist.
It sadly might not. I mean, she's just too aware of all the pains and ills of the world. So, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that, I don't know, I'm curious to hear what you think, but I think Daphne smells that out instantly.
Oh, but
she's kind of into it. She's like, ooh, let's play this game.
Yeah. Well, Daphne, if we learn anything from this episode, Daphne loves games.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Daphne loves to play. And I think she, to go back to sort of whether Daphne's as simple as we might have thought mm-hmm. she was from episode one with, you know, I don't vote, I love Ted Lasso. If anything, we know that she's much more complicated and a much more discerning character and a much more discerning judge of character than we might have given her credit for at the beginning of the season. And I think she 100% can sniff out Harper's bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
Harper's bullshitting her.
And I think that just as Harper, you know, in an earlier episode was being like, there's got to be something wrong with their marriage, she's trying to investigate it. I think Daphne's investigating Harper's relationship too, because she's like, how do you guys tick? Like, I know what deal I have with my shitty husband, Cameron, but like,
say that
we kind of enjoy this shittiness a little bit, you know, like she said last week, it's funny when he loses his temper, you know, mm-hmm. but I think she knows that there is something at root wrong in the other marriage. And she's just trying to sniff that out, and which involves kidnapping.
Yes, yes, and feeding her drugs.
Right,
exactly. Inedible and kidnapping. But yeah, I think the thing with Daphne and Cameron is that they play games with each other, but it's easy to forget that games are often fun. And she even says
right.
it. She says, you know, he goes off and does his things and I do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing about Daphne. She's not, to jump to her last sort of really fantastic and emotionally moving scene with Harper, she's not a victim. She
right.
does
yeah.
what she wants. She will rent the villa in Noto, whether or not Cameron wants her to. And she's as much in this marriage, she's sort of as equal in a way.
And I think that my kind of hunch about where this set of couples is headed in the kind of grander thematic reach of the season is I kind of think that it's going to kind of get to a point where you're like, oh, Cameron and Daphne's marriage is better than Harper and Ethan's.
Well,
because it's honest.
There's something about it that you can't say it doesn't work.
It's honest about being dishonest.
Yes, it's yeah. honest and it's dishonesty. And it is working for them, you know, maybe not all the time, but they seem to be at least somewhat on the same page, right?
Right.
And we get to Harper and Ethan, if we look at the end of the episode, Harper says, oh, Ethan never lies to me. Like, Ethan mm-hmm. would never lie to me. Who knows what's to come, but what Cameron and Ethan are up to, I would be shocked if,
yeah.
if Ethan says, hey, Harper, by the way, Cameron fucked a prostitute on her couch
yeah,
while
sorry.
You were gone.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. That's why I missed your call.
I kissed someone and I was on drugs and whatever. And I wasn't, you know, yeah, exactly. And I think that in that, and because Ethan says it too, I don't lie to my wife. And like, that's a nice sentiment in a kind of vacuum.
It's beautiful.
But it's so rigid that it makes it easy, you know, it makes the relationship that much easier to break.
And false.
And also, like, some lies help a relationship.
Yeah. Some lies are really important. Some lies do help. I'm curious to know what you think about Daphne's episode titled sort of speech about men,
oh, yeah.
Bull Elephant, right? And how men, it's so sad to be a man, and how they just go off alone.
Cameron and I went on a safari. And on safari, you see all these pods of elephants, and they're all, like, bathing in the river and playing with each other. And it's so sweet, but it's just the moms and the babies. Because when the boy elephants get too big, they kick them out of the pod. And then the bull elephant has to, like, wander through the jungle by himself for the rest of his life. I feel sorry for men, you know? It's like, they think they're out there doing something really important, but really they're just wandering alone.
And then we cut directly to Ethan and Cameron having the time of their lives on jet skis, sort of not a care in the world. What did you make of that sort of juxtaposition?
Yeah, that speech is so good. And I think what I love about The White Lotus as a whole and Mike White's writing as a whole is that it's ambivalent. It's like characters say things that are kind of true and kind of not, kind of sad, kind of not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a good example of that, where Daphne is, that is her perspective on things. Those are the men she knows. I mean, she says to Harper, his other coworkers are like this demonic triumvirate.
The triad.
And so she...
Psychotic triad.
She spends a lot of time with a specific kind of man. And so when you see what she says about elephants through that lens, you're like, okay, good on her for trying to have some compassion for it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Mike White is in juxtaposing that sentiment with like Ethan and Cameron having a blast together. If that's like supposed to be disproving her or sort of somehow proving her right. It's like mm-hmm. they think they're having these fun things, but all they're doing is competing with each other. All they're doing is one-upping each other. And so they are
alone
on
their jet skis.
In that experience.
Yes, they're completely isolated in that experience. I just think it's so, I love what you said about Mike White's writing and to have that sort of depiction of men, right? Of his thoughts about men or Daphne's thoughts about men. Right after we see Harper's sort of dream sequence walking through Italy, what it feels like to be Harper, right? We see her surrounded by all of these men just staring her down, eating her up with their eyes. And you can feel how uncomfortable and how that might be how certain women and many women probably feel walking through life all the time.
Yeah.
Not a woman to be found in that sequence. I thought it was such a, you know, such a nice little like lyrical moment to illustrate how Harper feels about being a woman.
Because it's both exciting and scary. You know, it's creepy. It's a little bit horror movie, but it's also, it's like that that movie Malena with Monica Bellucci where she sits down and then all the men come to light her cigarette. And, you know, it felt like maybe a reference to that or probably some older classic Italian film that I'm not aware of.
But, that works.
But yeah, it's also interesting from a kind of style point that like, this show doesn't go into that many like reveries like this.
No, that
and
was
there's
very...
a couple other things we'll get to, or one at least big one mystical element to this episode that you're like, what's going on here? There's something sort of simmering. I think it might have something to do with like the ancient Italy of it all. You know, I'm thinking about like Harper and Daphne being in this villa that's beautiful, but also you have to think about like. But so rich people used to live here, and now you can just rent it for the weekend. So that wealth goes away. Like all of this stuff that like. Cameron works so deviously for, like, it eventually goes away. Maybe not for them or their kids or their grandkids, but somewhere along the line, it becomes something that just people stay in for the night, you know? Yeah. And so I think there is a sense of, like, there's a kind of eerie creep around these people of, like history's coming for them or time is coming for them.
It's so interesting what you said about sort of the ruins and how, like, this, you know, Palazzo, like, it used to, you know, house these rich families and now you can rent it out for a night. It's sort of very similar to, or I see a parallel with that, to the Godfather of it all.
Oh, yeah. You know, you have to kind of wonder, like, are these people onto something in a way? I mean, I don't want to be that kind of person, but, like, they do seem just to get ahead for a while anyway.
Yeah, you know? And I will say Theo James is so pretty and charming that he sort of made it seem like it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, he's well cast.
He's really well cast, and it sort of... To go back to that, it sort of made sense why Ethan sort of just went along with him for the ride of the party when he knew it was getting out of hand, and it sort of starts to get out of hand. You can feel him start to freak out internally at the very end of the episode. But Cameron, say what you will, he's a good time.
This is a seduction.
It's a seduction.
You know, he's trying to seduce Ethan into investing with him, and that's an intricate process, it seems, but one that Cameron is well practiced at.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess you have to question then, is Daphne in on that seduction? Is she trying to get Harper to her cause? I don't know that dragooning Harper into an overnight in a different town is the good way to get to that particular person.
But it could work.
Kind of works in that, like, Daphne gets some information. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, I apologize that I keep referencing Survivor, but Mike White would probably appreciate it as a former Survivor contestant. But I think he's kind of writing Daphne as one of these clever players who is underlooked in the early episodes because she doesn't do well in the challenges and she's just a pretty girl. And then, like, halfway through the season, you're like, whoa, Daphne has an incredible strategic game. And how does she know who everyone who has an idol, like, immunity idol? Like, I just think that, like, Daphne is, I think, is sort of, like, one of Mike White's, like, platonic ideal Survivor players.
That is blowing my brain right now. I'm not even a Survivor head, but I'm like, oh, is she a Sandra? Like, is she, like...
there's a little Sandra in there, but it's funny the way that he is kind of writing... the sort of social strategy of all these people.
Yes.
You know, and some are better than others. I think you mentioned Godfather, so maybe we can lead us over to Albie and Portia and Albie's terrible strategy.
Oh, goodness.
Like, his heart's in the right place. He's at this Godfather luncheon looking at the mannequin. And he says all this stuff, which, again, with Mike White, the trickiness of his writing, the ambivalence is like, the kid is right.
Yeah.
I think,
gender
in a lot of ways.
Is a social construct.
But he's being annoying about it. And he's saying it in a way that's like, Portia has basically done everything she can except say it out loud, like, I want you to be a little dangerous and a little bit of a pig because, like, that's more fun. We're not going to get married. This is just a vacation tryst. So, like, can you just be a little bit whatever?
Yeah.
And Albie is just not listening, which in some ways makes him yet another obstinate, lonely man, you know? So in all his softness, he's actually kind of displaying some typical male stubbornness.
Yes, but I will push back on that specifically with the Godfather scene because I do think, while he becomes sort of the voice of Gen Z in that moment, oh, The Godfather, is it really a great movie or does it just glamorize an entire way of life that is now gone where men could go out and be violent and kill people and sleep with whoever they want and come back to like a nice bowl of spaghetti at the end of the day mm-hmm. from their loving wife? I think that's an interesting point of view that is often not interrogated because people are like, oh, well, you know, The Godfather is such a great movie or right. The Sopranos is such a great, or, you know, these are such classics. They're part of the canon. Mm-hmm. So we often don't wrestle with, oh, the social implications of that. And is that movie so great because, and this is the central argument, because men are hardwired to want to do that and that's what men do? Or is it because movies like that and entertainment like that have socialized us to, or socialized men or people to engage in the world in that
right.
way.
Is it nature or nurture? Yeah. And I think White would say it's both.
Yeah.
He would kind of shrug his shoulders and be like, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a little bit of, you know, and I think that you look at Albie and to some extent, I mean, not no, to a kind of big extent, Dominic is at least giving lip service to the idea that he's trying to break his own cycle.
Yeah.
Albie is clearly trying to break a family, a generational cycle by being, you know, the sensitive, woke, you know, whatever guy. But White, you know, draws the limits of that because is Albie doing it for the right reasons? Is he doing it organically? You know,
yeah.
And look, Portia is just one woman that he's interested in who just doesn't seem to, you know, cotton to what he's saying. Maybe other women would.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I think that that conversation in tandem with the elephant speech is like, you know, we're talking a lot about, like, the nature of men.
Yes.
And actually, Tanya, when she's having dinner with Portia, says something similar.
You already meet a guy here? Kinda. Yeah, I did. He's really smart and everything and went to Stanford. You know, one of those guys. He's really nice. Like, maybe a little too nice, you know? I wish he'd just, like, got my heart rate up a little bit more or something.
Portia, don't spend your life chasing emotionally unavailable men. Oh, you'll spend your whole life just banging your head against the wall.
So that scene is fascinating to me because, like, is this the first time on the show? Well, I guess Tanya had some moments of clarity in the first season, but like, this is the first moment I can distinctly remember where Tanya, it's like, oh, like, you're a human being who, like, actually has some insights into life.
You're someone whose opinion should be valued. Yeah, yeah, I should listen to you right now.
She's being kind, and we don't see that often, you know?
The funny thing, though, is her kindness comes from a total selfish place of my relationship has just gone to shit. A fortune teller has just told me my husband is cheating on me. She's spiraling. So
right.
She's not even being kind on purpose. She's being kind because yeah. She's spiraling because of her own life.
That's true.
So we can't give her too much credit there, I would say.
Tanya is not saying that to Portia purely out of like the care for another person.
Mm-hmm.
She's talking to herself.
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, but also at the same time being like, don't go the route I went.
That doesn't mean it's bad advice.
It's actually
pretty good advice. And yet, I think now we gotta fling open the doors of Casa Amor. And we got a hunk just entered the villa.
Oh, my
y'all.
God. Yeah.
We don't even know his name
Mr.
yet.
Mr. Poolman or something.
Cold Nipples Poolman.
Yeah.
In the red bathing suit. Straight off the set of Love Island.
Fully.
He comes in and honestly, and I want your take on this. I think if he was not in the pool that at that exact moment and Portia had not seen him, Portia and Albie would have made out and they would have, you know, maybe gone back to her room and everything could have been happily ever after for them. But this random man is so goddamn hot.
That's ridiculous. And that clearly,
he ruins it.
Clearly hot in a asshole way, you know.
An exact opposite way of Albie and exactly what Portia sort of has said that she wanted in a way.
Here's an aggressive bull elephant pushing the other one out of the pack, you know, out of the herd. And, you know, I don't imagine that this character is here by accident. I mean, I we'll probably see some more of him, as we probably will more of whoever this person that the actor Tom Hollander is playing, who keeps looking at Tanya. And she, I mean, I so relate to this. She thinks she's kind of being made fun of. She's like, do something with my shirt. When I was in college, I used to wait tables at this kind of diner / Jewish deli place. And these teenage girls were all kind of tittering every time I walked over the table. And I thought they were making fun of me. And so I kind of snapped and I went up to them and I was like, that's really, really rude. And I had like tears in my eyes. And they were like, what? We just thought you were cute. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry.
My heart.
So I hope that Tanya is wrong about these men kind of toying with her, because they seem genuinely interested. But to what end, we don't know.
We don't know yet. But yeah, they haven't done anything. That is one of the most heartbreaking and cutest stories I've ever heard in my life. I must say that.
It's the last time anyone called me cute. So I savor it.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with Michael Imperioli and theories about who's dead.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Chris, one of our listeners, Jacqueline, wrote into stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, which everyone should do.
Absolutely, everyone.
Theories, questions, thoughts, complaints.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
She has a theory that Portia might be secretly sleeping with Greg.
What now?
Yeah. Tanya's husband.
That would really complicate things. And I guess we have no idea who he's on the phone with.
Right.
Not to be ageist or anything like that. Greg doesn't seem like the caveman that Portia is maybe lusting for or imagining on this Sicilian trip. But who's to say at this juncture?
It might explain... Like, Portia has that kind of scene at breakfast where she's just having another spiral and she's like, I'm just so depressed at home and, like, is everything boring? And, like, maybe part of her sadness, anxiety, whatever, is related to an affair. I don't know.
It feels like that would be the least boring thing she could possibly do, though.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
She's lamenting that. And I think this is, again, another beautiful Mike White speech is... Everything boring. You go to some beautiful location in Sicily and you take a photo that everyone else has taken a photo and you're just contributing to the content mill and you can't even get lost anymore because you have a Google phone. And it feels like she's coming out of, you know, the malaise of the pandemic and wants to have something exciting. And that feels a bridge too far of an exciting thing to have happened to her. But I do think that's a very fun theory,
yes.
Jacqueline.
But, you know, speaking of listener emails, and we were talking about the Italy of it all, the Godfather fetishism of it all, a listener who lives in Perugia, Hannah, she's American, but she lives in Italy. She thinks that there's something about that Sicilian fantasy. And so she writes Bert's comment where he says, we're Sicilian, just like you, cracked me up, and maybe important to their visit to Bert's ancestral town. She says there are many Americans of Sicilian heritage. I am one of them, by the way. And they love to bring it up when they want to feel less white. But the real Sicily is so different, so very different from the Godfather Resort fever dream that so many have. The culture is very, very different. She says, I'm not an expert by any means, but I know that most of the Americans who like to brag about the baked ziti their Nona makes would shit their pants if they had to navigate the piles of trash and potholed roads outside of Palermo, which is the biggest city in Sicily. My husband, who works for a Sicilian company and whose grandparents are all Sicilian, refuses to live there. I am anxiously awaiting what happens when Grandpa encounters reality. Yeah, I mean, that's something, you know, we've spent a lot of this episode and really the past two episodes talking. And thank you, Hannah, for the comment. I wish I lived in Perugia. That sounds nice. We've talked a lot about the gender dynamics. This episode is heavy on that. But there are also the matters of class that that the White Lotus likes to be about. Where did that kind of manifest itself most potently in this episode? Is it still Lucia and Mia, or?
Yeah, I would say it's still Lucia and Mia. And I would say towards the end of the episode, when they're sort of, you know, up Schitt's Creek without a paddle after Dominic ends their relationship, and you have to see them be resourceful and sort of figure out how to stay within the enclave of the White Lotus. That's one way that we see the class issues. But then also we walk with Valentina to work and we see her sitting outside feeding cats and getting hit on by a Sicilian man. And we're sort of unraveling her story as the hotel manager. So I'm curious to see. I don't think we're going to get that far out of the walls of the White Lotus. But if we were, is that going to be through Valentina and her own personal story?
Something's happening with Valentina in this episode.
I think she's got a little bit of a crush.
I'm curious to see because, you know, by this point in the first season, we really knew Armand. Like he was a major part of the show, the hotel manager. So now his counterpart in Sicily, she hasn't really been that involved.
She hasn't eaten anyone's ass yet.
Right. That we know of.
That we've seen on camera.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious about that. And also there is the matter of Valentina having that disdain for Lucia and Mia. So where's that relationship going to go? And also Lucia and Mia are still on Dominic's payroll, whatever, on his dime. They're at least registered as guests in his and his dad's rooms.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I wonder if Dominic's new sobriety, if we want to call it that, if that's sustainable, which, I don't know. Is that a good time to cut to your conversation with Michael Imperioli?
I feel that's a great time just because I had the pleasure of interviewing Michael Imperioli about his work as Dominic this season. And we really talked about whether anyone has the capacity to change, like whether that's even possible. Dominic says that he wants to change, but clearly he's dealing with sex compulsion and addiction and a lot of personal issues. And we chatted for a while about whether or not we can change, whether or not people can change. It was really enlightening and edifying.
Well, let's hear that now.
I am so excited to be chatting with Michael Imperioli, who stars on The White Lotus season 2 as Dominic, a Hollywood producer with, I guess, some issues with impulse control, we might say. Thanks for joining me, Michael. How are you?
I'm great.
Yeah, we're going to dive into episode 3. It sort of kicks off with a bang. Sort of we open with Dominic sort of, you know, reeling from his night before. You got Lucia in bed. You've got Mia on the couch. And it seems to have a little bit of remorse, I guess, in that opening scene. I mean, what is sort of running through his brain, would you say? Or what was running through your brain, you know, when we wake up that morning?
You know, when I discussed the character with Mike White, we were both on the same page in terms of this guy's dealing with compulsive behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, you could call it sex addiction. A lot of people do. And meaning that he's doing stuff that he knows is going to cause him regret, remorse, guilt. And in the moment when he makes these decisions to do it, you know, he's under the grips of this kind of spell that, you know, this is going to be amazing and this is going to be great. And very much like when someone who's struggling with drugs or alcohol feels like, you know, the drink's going to make everything good. And then you wake up with a hangover the next day and you realize you did it again and you didn't want to do it. So I think really he's, you know, for these very fleeting, quick moments of pleasure, he's paying a gigantic price that he realizes he doesn't want to do anymore, but he hasn't found, you know, the way to kind of overcome it.
When did you get on board with White Lotus season two and sort of like discover that, you know, Dominic would be struggling with impulse control? Is it, how collaborative was that experience, I guess?
Well, I got on board after everything was written. You know, it was January, you know, we went to Italy towards the end of February. So around the end of January, I was cast. And, you know, we had a couple conversations. And for Mike, it was really about that. And as well as for me, that's what I felt. He's not someone who's just a cheat and a philanderer, although that is what he's doing in essence. But, you know, it's compounded by, you know, this compulsive thing that's driving him to do these negative behaviors, things that are very harmful to his life. You know, we spoke about addiction a lot because sex addiction is a tricky one, you know, like whereas like alcohol, drugs, or gambling, right? They're all things that if you have an addiction to them, you shouldn't do it, period.
It's sort of very clear,
People, there's Overeaters Anonymous, which is like deals with addiction to certain types of food. Well, we have to have food to eat. So you got to figure out ways of eating healthy that's not going to put your health in danger. Sex addiction is the same thing. Ideally, you want to have sex integrated into your life as a healthy element that's not going to kind of cause problems.
Absolutely.
It's not just like, well, I'm not never going to have sex for the rest of my life. So it's a, and it's accompanied by the stigma because it's your sexuality and it's very private. And B, the perception that you just want to have your cake and eat it too. You want to be married and have sex with, you know, young women.
So
we have no sympathy for you.
Well, that's so interesting because that seems to be, you know, Dominic's problem is that he wants his cake and he wants to eat it too. You know, he's, you know, he calls his wife on the phone in the first episode, right? And sort of, you know, wants her to come back. And it seems like his impulse control sort of has fractured his relationship with his family, potentially past the point of no return. I don't know, where do you think he stands with, you know, I mean, that scene was so wonderful with you on the phone with Laura Dern, if it turns out, which is so fantastic. Can you tell me a little bit about that scene and where he stands with his wife?
You know, he kind of wants her understanding, but knows that he hasn't earned it. He hasn't found a way to get a handle on this. And there are ways. I mean, there are 12-step programs similar to like AA or Narcotics Anonymous and things like that. There's therapy. There's, you know, but you have to, the key to overcoming an addiction, a compulsive behavior stuff is number one, admitting that you have a problem.
Yeah.
That it's making your life unmanageable.
Is he there yet? Do you think he's there yet?
I think that call with his wife might be the beginning of it.
Being on this trip with his father and his son simultaneously sort of complicates things even more. And it's so wonderful. I mean, the conversations that, you know, you and F. Murray Abraham and Adam DeMarco as, you know, as Bert, your grandfather, and then as Albie, your son, have about how men operate in society. And a little bit for Dominic, I'm a little bit like, given Bert and his, you know, his sort of lecherous, you know, attitude towards women, is it sort of learned behavior? Is it nature? Is it nurture for Dominic? Like, you know, how much, how responsible is he for the position that he's in, given his relationship with his father and his father in general?
I mean, I think it's both, you know, nature and nurture, you know, it's learned behavior. But as far as stopping it, overcoming it, it's completely his responsibility. You're not going to stop it by blaming it on your father. You have to accept that, you know what? When I was a kid, I was exposed to certain things were normalized, and maybe that kind of contributed to me going that direction. But blaming my dad ain't going to solve the problem. You know, you know, he's got to learn to take responsibility and just say, you know, I think also his success, because the White Lotus, you know, a lot of it's about rich people. His success and his wealth, I think, allowed him to kind of justify certain things. And like, he doesn't want a girlfriend. He doesn't want a new wife. I think, but he's, you know, his success is kind of justified. Well, I've made all this money. I take care of the family. Everybody has a great life because of me. So I have this little thing where I, you know, that I do. It's not really hurting anybody. But the fact is, it is hurting people.
Dominic is not the only man by any means, sort of struggling with sort of these impulses and sort of and struggling and maybe trying to change or not trying to change on The White Lotus season two. I mean, going into this, was Mike White, was he just like, hey, we're really going to like examine how men operate in society. We're really just going to dig into sex this season. Like how clear was he about the message of the entire season? Because we're seeing it, you know, in all these different pockets throughout the show.
I think, you know, it's inherent in the writing. It's really, the theme is very different than season one, where this really focuses on sexual politics, but both in like Albie's character representing kind of the modern male's like take on it post Me Too.
Yes.
There's Bert, which represents kind of like the old world that they brought over from Italy. You know what I mean? That the guy's the king of the castle and all that stuff. And then me, who's kind of caught in between both and sees kind of, you know, understands both sides, you know. But I think sexual politics and sexual dynamics between, you know, men and women and masculine and feminine has been going on. It's an ancient thing, which I think why Sicily makes it kind of the perfect backdrop for it, because you have such a connection to the ancient world being in Sicily. And I think that, I think that kind of adds to the drama, you know.
It does. It absolutely expands and adds to the drama. And I speaking of the drama and speaking of sort of this sort of like this the sexual politics, I mean the scene, the Godfather scene, that and the conversation about the Godfather sort of encapsulates exactly the dynamic that you just hit on, with, you know, I'll be being, you know, post Me Too, sort of, you know, a Gen Z man, you know, and having, you know, be sort of saying The Godfather isn't that great of a film. And then Bert and Dominic being like, are you kidding me? It's an amazing film. Just because it's, you know, sort of old world and sort of old fashioned doesn't mean that it, you know, is not a good film. I love that. Can you tell me a little bit about that scene and sort of that debate? Because that seems to be the central debate of, you know, your character's stuck in the middle and you've got like Bert on one side and Albie on the other. And, you know, The Godfather, it's a classic, but it also, did it socialize men to sort of behave in a certain way?
You know, it's an interesting argument, because I found a lot of art got re-examined post Me Too, post art and the artist. So a lot of artists' behavior getting called out, and then people like, you know, you shouldn't show his work anymore. You shouldn't watch his work, and validating the work, which is, you know, I'm not sure if that's, you know, the right way to go. And then re-examining like somebody like Henry Miller or Charles Bukowski, or people like that, who, you know, a lot of their work is, you know, sexist. That's kind of their relationships with women in a lot of ways had that element. Yet they were very good writers. And their writing style and the way they told their stories are very, very compelling. Does it negate the worth of that art because the politics are outdated or the mentality is outdated? I don't think so. My grandmother loved The Godfather. I remember when I was a kid, they had it on TV and they put Godfather 1 and 2 and in chronological order over a week on NBC, I think, network television. And I watched it with my grandmother, and she loved that movie to death.
That's so interesting, because, you know, of course people love things that are flawed and problematic. And I think the thing that's amazing about Dominic, and something that Mike White really gets about characters, that everyone is flawed. So all of these are, you know, when we have the conversation about art and the artist and separating them, there is no perfect, unassailable artist or piece of art that doesn't have maybe something that might be flawed.
But because we're all flawed, right?
Because we're all inherently flawed. And that's exactly what Dominic, you know, he's struggling with that, I think, in a really compelling way. It's funny, because when I was watching the Godfather scene, I was like, oh, we could be having this conversation. This could be about The Sopranos. I mean, thinking about a piece of art that you know, that it's, you know, amazing and incredible, and, you know, but also it's sort of about how men, you know, toxic masculinity, one might say. Did you like draw a parallel between that? Or
yeah, I mean, you definitely can see it. But the important thing about The Sopranos or something like The Godfather is like they're trying to honestly portray that world. Like if you were going to go and make The Sopranos and Tony Soprano was some PC guy, would you know, people aren't stupid. They're going to say this is bullshit. This is this is like the writer pandering to the current, you know, social situation. And also like just because a work of art is about like an important social issue and kind of presents it doesn't really mean that it's a good work of art. It just means it's an important social issue. The good work of art is in the execution of it and how well it's made. You know, we kind of confuse these two things now. And I think that's not so good always.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It actually often leads to bad art. the message might be on point or, it might be, and I get, and this is a criticism that I feel was lobbed against White Lotus season one, which I never understand this criticism. People are like, oh, all these rich people doing terrible things. Like, who wants to see that? And it's like, I love to see that. It's like, I don't want to just watch nice people doing nice things. Where's the drama in that? Where's the excitement? It's like, I want to see flawed people, engaging in the world and learn something from that.
Yes. And I think a lot of people see, even if they're not rich, which probably most people who watch the White Lotus probably are not rich, or might be middle, whatever, see themselves in a weird way, just behaviorally, in the way people behave with each other, in their feelings of expectations or their feelings of, in especially in this season when it's all about relationships. I think there's both a vicarious thing, seeing how these rich people live, but there's also kind of a relatable thing at the same time, you know what I mean? You don't have to be rich to kind of expect certain things out of your marriage.
Yeah.
What I mean? Like this is what I'm expecting your role to be in this, So I think it appeals to a lot of people.
In that way. I mean, it transcends, one sort of echelon, even though it shows like, how people in that sort of echelon, that sort of hyper 1%, how they act. And it's not that different than how you or I or like anyone acts, we all struggle with, the same sort of carnal desires.
And we all get angry. We all get jealous. We all get, full of desire. We all get, arrogant. It's like emotions are universal. And it's just like, it's kind of the stage that it's playing out that's specific.
Yeah. I mean, that's so true. This is a little odd, but how do you feel Christopher, your Sopranos character, what would he think of Dominic? Would he like him? I keep thinking it was like, sometimes question. I feel like maybe.
I think if they spoke about addiction, he would understand that because he's somebody who went to rehab and was in 12 step and tried really hard to get sober and struggled with it and failed at it. And, he's certainly not as smart as Dominic. But he might relate on that feeling of, impulse, behaviors that you want to control that you can't. He might relate on that.
Yeah, he relate on that. Wow. That is really fantastic. Wow. Michael, thank you so much for joining me. This is so...
Thank you.
This has been really a fantastic conversation.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
All right, Chris, it's time for our favorite, most morbid segment of any episode of Still Watching the White Lotus. We got to talk about who we think is dead. Yeah. We know there is at least two bodies in the water.
A few bodies.
I think
in the
several
water.
Is the word used in the first episode. So just to refresh, week one, Chris, you said Tanya.
Yeah. Strong week for Tanya being dead, given the fortune teller. I will say that.
Yeah, that's true. So maybe we're back to Tanya. I said me and Lucia. Last week you said maybe Harper, and I said Portia and Albie in some sort of rescue gone wrong.
Ophelia.
Right, exactly. But Chris, we're not the only ones with theories.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe to get us started with our own ideas this week of who might be dead, we'll go to some listeners who wrote in again to stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Gavin writes with a dark theory. The images of bodies washing ashore on Mediterranean beaches has become a terribly regular sight over the last decade as boats carrying refugees from North Africa sadly capsize. I rate Mike White too highly to think he's utilizing this iconography unintentionally or without cause. And although the bodies seen in episode one turning out to be refugees fleeing a war may be a little too far-fetched for the show, I do think the way the dead characters are discovered is thematically important. It would suggest to me that they may be working-class characters such as Mia and Lucia, and that White is once again displaying the disposability with which the wealthy view those of a lower class, which, you know, makes sense to me.
That does make sense, specifically tied to Mia and Lucia. That would be quite dark, quite tough. But I don't think that he would go so far as to bring in characters that we didn't necessarily know or have mm-hmm. followed for a few episodes just to make a salient point about the refugee crisis. But I do think that definitely adds a point to Mia and Lucia maybe not being long for this world.
And then Crystal writes to us and she says, my theory is that the, quote, perfect couple Cameron and Daphne is an obvious ruse perpetuated by Daphne because once Ethan became a new billionaire, they started an affair back home. I mean, this foursome vacation makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The plan is to off Cameron and make it look like an accident. This is why the show opens with her telling two total strangers what an amazing and romantic time she was having there. Cameron was the floater. Perfect alibi for the soon-to-be hysterical grieving wife. One more swim before the flight? Yeah, right. I love that, Crystal. That is fun.
That is fun as hell. Yeah. That is,
and it puts Daphne right back in the driver's seat, which is where we want her.
We love it. Yeah. Love it. And you know what? I could see, Daphne and Ethan hitting it off. I could definitely see that. That's fun. That's dishy.
If Cameron is the one in the water, though, who are the other people or other person? Maybe it's just two people. I don't know. But like, Ethan.
Yeah, maybe Cameron and Ethan get into some sort of.
Maybe they hook up.
They hook up, and then they get into a macho brawl, and it just devolves from there, and they tear each other limb from limb.
Yeah, could be. I got to say, this week it's boring, but I'm going to go back to my original theory. I mean, I think Gavin's email kind of swayed me toward me and Lucia, partly because, the more that we watch the show, they're the only characters who have touched everyone's lives so far. I guess they haven't really done anything with Portia and Tanya, but like they're around. I think Portia's aware of them. It would make sense that the people floating between all these different groups are the ones who ultimately end up suffering at one of their hands or something, right?
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. And also, with the drugs now, we now know Molly's,
Sure, yeah.
Molly's in the conversation and crazy things can happen when drugs happen, so.
She also has Viagra.
she does have both. Yeah, that is, yeah. She
and
does.
Cameron's like, oh, we don't need that. And it's like, if you had coke, you might.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now that, say that. Wow, who do I think is in the water this week? You know what? I'm going to go with someone that you said before, but for a different reason. And I'm going to bring back our hunk from the water, who we don't know anything about.
No, we don't.
We don't know literally anything about him. And he's framed in such sort of like a lustful way. He's almost too good to be true.
Right.
And when people are too good to be true, often something insidious and something bad is bubbling underneath. Yeah. So I'm worried about our girl Portia. She's lost. She wants some excitement. She wants to let her hair down. Albie's not good enough for her anymore because he's too nice. And I could see her getting, roped into a whirlwind love affair with Mr. Love Island himself. And maybe that doesn't go well for her.
Maybe things get a little too exciting.
Yes. And that is something we have to be careful of. I hope that doesn't happen.
That would be Mike White making a very bleak statement.
Yeah,
but like
very explicit and very bleak.
He can be a bleak guy. I mean, have you seen Beatrice at Dinner?
I actually have not.
Oh well, you should see it. It's really good. But
my homework for
this
week.
Some bleakness involved in that, certainly. So that's it for this week's episode. As always, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com with theories about who's dead or
questions, comments, concerns.
What the hunk's name might be, all that kind of
stuff. What his number might be.
Yeah, more importantly.
If you have it, send it to us.
And if you don't want to email, you can always find us on Twitter. I'm at Rylaws, which is R-I-L-A-W-S.
And I'm at Christress, which is C-H-R-I-S-T-R-E-S-S.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Rich. We had technical assistance from Scott Lee. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week for episode 4. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.